This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. What are we other than our brains? Is there a part of me that can't be changed by a brain injury? These questions are posed by a brain injury case manager and certified brain injury specialist, Michael Paul Mason, in his book, Head Cases, Stories of Brain Injury and Its Aftermath. Mason says a brain injury is never an isolated incident. To quote him, it affects nearly everything associated with the survivor. It can collapse a family and flatten a business, evaporate friendships and allegiances, overburden a community, and buckle a state's healthcare system. In Head Cases, Mason tells the stories, among others, of a snowboarder who suffered a brain injury on the slopes and suffers 120 seizures a month, and a young woman nearly killed in a car train wreck whose injured brain keeps her forever in the present. There are also veterans of Iraq and Iraqi civilians. Traumatic brain injury is said to be the signature wound of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. More than 10,000 American soldiers have been treated for traumatic brain injuries. This afternoon, we'll talk about brain injury with Michael Paul Mason. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Michael Paul Mason's book, Head Cases, Stories of Brain Injury and Its Aftermath, is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. A portion of the proceeds from sales of the book will be donated to the Brain Injury Association of America. Again, the phone numbers, if you'd like to join us this afternoon, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Michael Paul Mason, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for having me
on the show. When you began working in this field, your boss warned you that most of the people you would meet wouldn't get the help they need. Why not?
Well, that's true. He knew what I was about to learn, which is that the number of injuries in America far exceeds the available services and programs available to survivors of that injury. The new figures that are about to be released will indicate that there are 1.6 million brain injuries occurring each year in America, and that 125,000 of those are severe enough to require hospitalization.
Yeah, and the aftermath is so long. The aftermath is like, I suppose you could liken it to running a marathon.
Yeah, and I actually have likened it to a marathon in the book. Depending on the severity of the injury, the complications resulting from a TBI or traumatic brain injury can go the course of the lifetime. That being said, there can also be gains to be made no matter how long the person survives post-injury.
Well, talk with us then a little bit about that. What kind of therapeutic treatments are available for people, and we can have all different kinds of brain injury?
Well, typically what's supposed to happen is that once the brain injury occurs, the person goes to a hospital, and depending on the severity, you know, they'll either be admitted or not. If they're admitted, they go, you know, from, you know, the emergency room into some kind of medical stabilization, potentially ICU, and then from there they'd go to an acute rehab stay, which means that they would be further medically stabilized. Most insurance companies, and policies will take care of the individual up through that phase, which may last about a month. The problem is that once that phase of treatment is over, very few policies cover the very necessary component, which is a specialized brain injury rehabilitation that occurs in what's called a post-acute rehab setting. And my estimates place the number of beds in America somewhere between the 3,000 to 5,000 range. So you can imagine that that's not quite serving the you know, more than 125,000 people that could use it.
Yeah. And this so affects not only the person who's injured, but their families.
Oh, tremendously so. I mean, you know, you can only imagine what it would be like to get home from the hospital and suddenly not remember how to do your job or how to make breakfast or, you know, how to find your way around your own house. So immediately the family sort of rallies to support the person. But this all comes at extreme opportunity costs and financial costs as well. Most estimates place the average brain injury cost at being somewhere in the $3 to $5 million range per lifetime, per individual over the lifetime, I should say. And when it's a military service member, that cost can go up to over $15 million, and that's because the injury often accompanies other kinds of injuries on top of the brain injury.
Yeah. So what are we looking at long-term because of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars?
Well, there was one Harvard economist who estimated that the cost of treating the Iraq war wounded would exceed the cost of war itself. So we're looking at billions and billions and billions of dollars.
The wars have taken a terrible toll on soldiers and civilians. In February of last year, 2007, you went to Iraq. Would you tell us about what you found there, the hospital? Maybe you would tell us about Juan Morales.
Sure. Well, I actually met Juan Morales a little bit before going to Iraq. I had gone to a Minneapolis polytrauma rehab where I met a number of soldiers, and you know, when I you know, saw them face to face, I realized that they were surviving injuries far more severe than anybody had ever survived in their lives. They were walking around with portions of their skulls missing, and yet they were cognitively pretty remarkably intact, which is a real testament to the military's care of the soldiers at the acute phase. And so I was invited by the Department of Defense to go to Iraq in February of last year. And when I got there, I was astonished by the entire healthcare system that they had in that trauma phase of treatment. If a person is able to be able to make it into the doors at the Balad Hospital, which is about it's on an Air Force base 30 miles north of Baghdad, if they can make it into those doors, they stand a 98% chance of surviving, which is much better than any hospital in the U.S. So once they make it into those doors, they are often greeted by an entire team of surgeons. There's no waiting room, so they immediately get treatment. And they can go from the door to the operating room table within 18 minutes. That typically takes about 2 to 3 hours here in the U.S. just because of paperwork and staff availability and that type of thing. But there they have it really effective and a procedure, or I should say a protocol known as throughput. They're able to get people in and out of that hospital very quickly. Within 72 hours of being in that hospital, troops are then flown to Landstuhl, Germany, where they're further medically stabilized. And then within a day or two later, they're also sent back home. The problem many veterans face is that once they return home, access to service is very difficult. There are only 4 polytrauma rehab centers in the U.S. right now, 5 now, and a new one in San Antonio. And, that leaves a lot of people out of geographical reach, I should say.
Yeah. One of the things you say in this chapter of the book is that you can survive more injuries than you'd care to know. And I found myself wondering, would I care to survive such severe injuries?
Yeah, that's a very difficult question to answer. And for the most part, the military is answering that question for the soldier at least in the war setting, in the theater setting, because at those early critical phases of saving someone's life, they don't have the time to look for advanced directives or paperwork that indicate wishes otherwise. So typically what happens is that if it's a very severe injury and there's a question as to, you know, whether the individual would want their life sustained, the family is often brought into the picture when the person is flown to Germany. So they've survived, you know, a few days at least. Then the question then becomes, you know, even though you have, as a service member, you can stipulate whether or not you want your life saved, but your family also has to agree with your wishes. And as you can imagine, most families are so thrilled to learn that that the service member's life was saved, that their loved ones was saved, that they choose to keep them alive with the hope that they'll return to fully functioning individuals just in the same way they were before. But usually that kind of injury comes with some very serious lifelong impairments, and you know, there's the possibility that they will not regain consciousness either. So very tough decisions to make.
Yeah. One of the other things you say in this portion of the book is that we're no longer asking most soldiers to die in service. We're asking them to accept a lifetime of severe disability.
That's right. You know, we know the death toll in Iraq has exceeded 3,000, I believe, now.
4,000,
excuse me. And at the same time, we also know that in the global war on terror, over 400,000 people have applied for disability. And so, you know, we're not to discredit the very small number of individuals that have died relatively to the number of people that do or are requesting disability status, but this is a huge number of disabilities, and so the likelihood is that you, if you do sustain an injury in Iraq, the military will do everything they can to save your life. You just should be aware of the fact that, you know, the odds are that, you know, you will be asked to live with a disability.
Mm. What's the situation for civilians, in particular Iraqis, who have suffered brain injury?
Well, this is a very grim and heart-wrenching topic for me. Once an Iraqi person is injured, the American military will give them the exact same level of care and effort to sustain and save their lives, just as they would an American soldier. However, what happens after that person is stabilized is that they have to be transferred back into the Iraqi healthcare system. And that system is in shambles. I mean, it's, to give you an example, prior to the Iraq War, Iraq had 30,000 physicians operating. Now, the latest figure that I heard, which was 6 months ago, is that that figure is down to 2,000. So another Iraqi liaison actually told me that the physicians that are left there operating and taking care of patients, many of them he wouldn't give the same licensure that a registered nurse would receive in the U.S. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, education there has pretty much ground to a halt for physicians, and many of them are, you know, many of the remaining physicians are in fear for their lives. They are often kidnapped and held for ransom because they command, you know, high ransom monies.
And Iraqis treated by the Americans, they must not speak of it.
That's true. If an Iraqi gets treated in an American facility, they risk getting killed for receiving that kind of treatment. So it's something that it's a level of care that the Iraqis are grateful to receive, but it comes at the extreme cost of being very dangerous once they return back to their community.
Yeah. You write about a little boy who is 7 years old when you see him. What was his prognosis when he was sent home? He had a severe brain injury.
Well, physiologically, his prognosis was good in the sense that they were able to stabilize him medically, and that he was, responding and conscious and that type of thing. If he had gone to America, he would have gone to rehabilitation hospital, but there are no such things in Iraq, so he would have gone home to his family. His father was instructed to treat his wounds in such a way to guard against infection. But I received an email from the neurologist, neurosurgeon, who had operated on the young boy, and he told me that even though they give them the best education that they can, that children rarely have the stamina to survive infections like adults do. And, many of them die as a result of that.
Mm. Michael Paul Mason is our guest in this portion of the program. He is the author of Head Cases, Stories of Brain Injury and Its Aftermath. He's a brain injury case manager and certified brain injury specialist. He's a vice president of the Brain Injury Association of Oklahoma. He speaks frequently on this topic and has written articles about it for Discover Magazine. A portion of the proceeds from sales of the book will be donated to the Brain Injury Association of America. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. In my introduction, I mentioned a woman who was injured in a car train wreck. Her name is Julie. Would you tell us how the family and her family and loved ones have been affected by her injury?
Oh, wow. Well, yeah. There's been a tremendous effect on her family. She was in a train wreck several years ago. And when she emerged from the coma that she was in, she found that she had no memory. She could not remember her five-year-old daughter who had died in the train wreck. And she also lost all memory of, I believe it was about 15 or 16 years of marriage to her husband, Rick. So you can imagine the kind of heartbreak that Rick had to endure in a sense of it being something of a double loss. You know, when his wife finally woke up, she didn't recognize him, and she wasn't able to grieve their daughter's loss along with him. So it was a very trying, difficult time for that family. And, the memory loss extended to everyone that she knew. She simply didn't know who her sisters were, who her parents were, and found that most of her memory simply didn't return.
Yeah. How does she feel about her life? And, it leads me to ask this other question as well. Can she have feelings about her life given her situation?
Well, when you speak to her, you get the feeling that you're talking to someone who inhabits a very different world than we're accustomed to, because so much of who we are and how we perceive ourselves requires memory. But Julie only has certain kinds of memory left. She hardly has any short-term memory. Her long-term memory is nearly gone, but she does have procedural memory. So she knows how to do things. She has semantic memories, so she remembers the names of things. So she knows, for example, her daughter's name, but she doesn't have any images or other kinds of memories associated with her. She has a declarative memory as well, so she knows certain facts about her life, but they're not connected emotionally. So almost the only thing that really exists to her in a way that we can relate is the very immediate present moment.
Mm.
And she's able to gauge this by how you react to it as well. You know, every time I walked up to her, I noticed that I was that she would scrutinize me for telltale signs as to whether or not I would indicate to her whether she knew me or not. So each time I was potentially a stranger or a loved one to her, and she had no knowledge until I would, you know, call her by her name and stand maybe a little bit closer to her than a stranger would, and, you know, ask her about her life and mention people that she knew, to, you know, suggest to her that I was familiar with her life.
Yeah, one of the ways you describe her is to call her pure empathy.
That's true, I think it's a subtlety that you know, may be lost on people who casually visit with someone like Julie, because looking at her or even approaching her, you wouldn't really identify her as someone with a brain injury. She looks pretty normal on the outside. It's a very invisible kind of injury.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you are sad, she will become sad because she's mirroring that emotional state at the moment.
So what's a day life like in her life?
Well, she holds a journal to her chest almost at all times, and she's constantly making little notes to herself about little things that have passed throughout the day, because she's attempting to use it as sort of a replacement for her memory. And so, you know, she kind of lives in this world where, you know, it's just a sight, emotional sight, only exists for 5 or so minutes. So, you know, she goes to all the therapies that all of the other patients go to, and she eats lunch, and she, you know, takes care of her daily activities. But whereas we perceive a kind of string of events, these are all kind of new, isolated incidents for her. And so she doesn't really, because of that lack of memory, she's not really able to plan for anything far ahead of time or even anticipate it, because she can't, you know, memory requires some functional level to be able to anticipate something. And she also can't, recall what it was that, you know, for example, what she had for breakfast or anything like that. So It's just sort of a world that appears and vanishes as quickly as it arises.
Yeah. You ask, will any of her memories ever return? Is there any way to even hazard a guess?
Well, I am pleased to report that, you know, since the writing of the book, it seems like some hint of memories are coming back to her. Like, occasionally she will say something like, you know, I remember that person from high school, or, you know, I remember that name, you know, and it maybe she's not able to describe the person, but little things are coming back. And the hope is that her brain will somehow be able to someday to access those memories that seem inaccessible at the moment.
Yeah. Do you keep in touch with the people that you've worked with?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Most of the people in my book I stay in pretty steady contact with. But over the course of my job, I've, you know, evaluated hundreds and hundreds of people, and so there's no realistic way for me to remain in touch with them.
Michael Paul Mason, author of Head Cases, Stories of Brain Injury and Its Aftermath, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon. Join the discussion with a phone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now, a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello. I have a question for the guest. I have not heard the term certified brain injury specialist before, and I'm curious what his background is for that certification and what the certifying body is and so forth that prepares and certifies these specialists.
Sure. The name of the body that does the certification is called the American Academy of Certified Brain Injury Specialists, and I believe the website is aacbis.net, I think. And basically what this requires is, a professional employment in, I believe that this is the criteria, professional employment in the brain injury field, as well as a rather grueling, intensive study of a big manual on brain injury and its treatment and current protocols for dealing with brain injury. You are given a proctored test. And following this test and training, then you receive certification.
Oh, okay. I know that locally, I have a brain injury and have had for about a little over 3 years. And locally, we have speech and language pathologists that work with cognitive rehab and neuropsychology people, but I was unaware of the role that that you have or the case manager type of role, and I was just curious what that entailed and who typically would pursue that kind of preparation in the healthcare system?
Yeah, sure. Basically, as a brain injury case manager, I worked a little bit backwards as opposed to most of them. Most brain injury case managers stay within the hospitals that employ them, and they simply facilitate discharge planning. And so they're always trying to find, help for a patient that they currently have and get them to the next phase of treatment. I sort of worked at the front end. In other words, I would go out and do the clinical evaluations of brain injury survivors prior to their admission, full well knowing that their admission was very unlikely in the hospital where I worked. I mean, we only had 19 beds, and most of them were filled for years at a time. So I would go out and I would do these, and basically what my job amounted to was teaching the survivor and their caregivers how to overcome the challenges within their respective systems. So they would, wrangle state laws and Medicaid and all that really tricky stuff, and I would kind of teach them how to work that system.
One final question, then I'll hang up and listen to the rest. I understand that in our community, the main group of people who fall through the crack on getting cognitive and other rehab are people who come through emergency room with diagnosis of concussion and are not ever admitted to the hospital. Do you have any thoughts on how to create a safety net to follow up those kind of situations?
Oh yeah, thank you for asking. That's a very pressing question on the minds of not only civilian physicians but military as well. As you may know, the milder injuries are far more. I call them mild, but there's actually an effort to reclassify brain injury because the current classifications as mild, moderate, and severe are not as effective as they once seemed to be. But anyway, there is a movement to sharpen identification and early treatment of brain injury because mild injuries are so common and yet they are commonly underdiagnosed and misdiagnosed. As a case manager, I had fielded hundreds of calls from people who were turned down from emergency rooms, telling people to simply go back home and take aspirin for head pain and that kind of thing. But when they return home, they, maybe notice that they no longer had a sense of smell or that they became very irate and agitated and maybe started having seizures and that kind of thing. So there are a lot of initiatives to improve early screening protocols.
Let's take another call now. A listener in Urbana, line two, hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hello. Thank you very much. I have a close friend who was hit in the head with a golf ball maybe 6 months ago and was in a coma and has just pretty much fallen through the cracks as far as aftercare. And I was wondering where I can go on the Internet to learn more how I can possibly help him with his problems.
Yeah, well, thank you for asking that question. It's, I think, a very important one. One of the first things I think that is probably in order if your friend hasn't done this is to get a comprehensive neuropsychological evaluation done. And this should come with a recommendation for treatment. So what is likely to happen is that the neuropsychologist will say, your friend needs this kind of rehabilitation treatment. The question then becomes, how do you find that given wherever he may live? And that question boils down to geography. I mean, you can have a very different, level and outcome if you live in Iowa as opposed to Illinois or Missouri. Depending on where you live, each state has a completely different offering or lack of offering. In Illinois, you do have a reputable brain injury rehab in Carbondale that may be able to offer really helpful services. And I always encourage people to also look at the Brain Injury Association of America website, BIAUSA.org. And they list, they have a wealth of information on that site that you can download, and you can also call them and request to get an informational packet sent to you.
Okay. He is on an anti-seizure medication, and we have seen a remarkable decrease in his functioning over the last probably 2 months. Mm-hmm. And it's very alarming. He is completely agitated, has absolutely no memory of anything.
And do you know if he has had any post-acute rehabilitation?
He has not.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's typical. And it's probably even more likely that his insurance probably doesn't cover it. And even if they do cover it, it probably isn't for the right length of time. That's why the neuropsychological evaluation is so important, because it has a doctor's signature on there suggesting the proper protocol. So what would be an ideal situation is if he were able to somehow challenge the state where he resides to fund his treatment to get brain injury rehabilitation, where the doctors there would probably then have a much more precise sense of how to manage his seizures. There's also the possibility that you could take your friend to a place that specializes in seizure treatment, with the help of an epileptologist. You might be able to turn things around for him.
Very good. Thank you so much, and I will track your buck down.
No, thank you.
Goodbye.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Yeah, in the book, you do, in the back, you include a number of resources for people.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Michael Paul Mason is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Head Cases, Stories of Brain Injury and Its Aftermath. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. We've got about 10 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join us with a question, a comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, speaking of seizures, I'm wondering if you would tell us a little bit about Cheyenne Emmerich and how he's doing.
Yeah, Cheyenne had his brain injury on the slopes. He was a snowboarder, and he was a really popular, outgoing athlete. And, just had a terrible accident one day where he miscalculated a jump, and he ended up slamming his forehead into his knee. Soon after that, he began developing what he thought were severe anxiety attacks, but were actually absence seizures. And he was experiencing these daily, and instead of getting help, he just continued to snowboard. And, about a year later, a grand mal seizure stuck, got him out of the blue and struck him down. And when he went to the emergency room and they did all the testing on him, they discovered that he had a lesion on his frontal lobe, and it pretty much, stopped his snowboarding career right there. But it also initiated this current struggle that he has, where he experiences 120 seizures a month, some of them grand mals, but most of them absent seizures. So you can imagine how this is affecting his life. Yeah. He's not able to hold down a job. He's unable to maintain stable relationships. He's become very insecure. He's also become a recluse. Since the writing of the book, he has attempted suicide, and that actually got him a little bit of help for his brain injury. But following that suicide attempt, he's since sort of bounced in and out of homelessness. He has to decide whether he's going to pay for medications or food. And obviously, most of the time, he chooses food.
Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hello. I'm so interested to read your book.
Thank you.
Our member of our family had a serious accident, and with a very traumatic brain injury, a young man at 24. As I listened to you, I realized how fortunate that it happened in Minneapolis.
Oh, yeah.
That he was close to Hennepin County Medical Center.
Yeah.
At Courage Center Rehab was there. He's really had, I think, amazing care, and it's hard to imagine the stress on all of us if we had had to negotiate that without the kind of support that his family got just immediately from the hospital staff. But I wondered if you could talk a little bit about sort of what happens to people's social networks after sort of the initial recovery.
That's a fantastic mm-hmm. question. Your friend, family member was very fortunate to get help in Minneapolis, because not only do they have great medical care, they also have one of the most active brain injury association chapters in the U.S.
Right.
So they do a fantastic job for survivors there. A lot of times what happens is there's a big rally during the phase of the immediate injury, and right after that for a few weeks, you know, a lot of people come by to pay visits and all that kind of thing. And then once the reality of the injury sets in, there's this sort of horrific disengagement from almost everybody but the closest of family members and friends. So
that's been our experience.
Yeah,
I think that they expected him to be there when he came out of the coma.
Right.
Him.
And the brain is such a slow healing organ.
Yeah.
That the person, you know, really needs a lot of time to get back and a lot of support. And it's kind of a tragedy that at a time where the person probably needs their social support more than ever, it actually vanishes mm-hmm. From them.
Yeah. Well, I'm so looking forward to getting your book. I think I might be able to read it now. Thanks.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, healthcare is a huge political issue, and with all that we've heard here this afternoon, brain injury needs to be part of the discussion.
Yes, that's very much the case. I mean, you can, you know, the caller described a situation where the person was injured in Minneapolis, and the survivor fortunately had very good care there. But, you know, what happens if that accident happens, say, in western Nebraska, you know, where there aren't any brain injury rehabs and there aren't really many services. You know, there's not a neuropsychologist around to do any testing, no neurologist. What's a person to do? And what often ends up happening is if the family can't help them, they either go to a nursing home or they go to a mental health ward, which is, to me, a really grievous displacement. But it's the only answer that many states have.
Yeah, it's really sad reading the story of the young man who survived suicide and is in Nebraska in I don't know how to describe it. Hell, I would describe it, Evan.
Purgatory,
at least, yeah. And, you know, one of the things also I would like you to talk about a little bit is here. Throughout the book, you write about Dante and insights that the Inferno has given you. Would you talk about that and what your writing means to you in terms of how you think about brain injury, how you process the stories of these people?
Well, you know, I've often, been interested in the way we talk about the brain and how it corresponds with how we talk about the self. It's my impression that when we use words like awareness and consciousness and attention and that kind of thing, that we're, you know, it's analogous to, you know, Hippocrates talking about the four humors. We really don't have the right words to accurately express these very complex and at present mysterious components of mind and body. And so I've drawn quite a bit from the wisdom of Dante in understanding our sort of universal condition. You know, it was impressive to me that in his Inferno that he would talk about the Wood of the Suicides being a place in the Inferno in which people could only express themselves in times of suffering. And that seems to be the case in my experience, that there is a certain intimacy that brain injury allows people to really talk about what's on their heart and, you know, to deal with these very difficult questions of existence and you know, identity. So, I presented those questions as often as I could in the book, because it's my feeling that the brain injury, above all other injuries, is the most spiritual injury, that it really forces people to ask who they are fundamentally.
Yeah. What are we other than our brains is the question you ask early in the going.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We have to wrap up here pretty quickly. I want to talk just really briefly, get your thoughts about prevention. You know, prevention has its limitations, and, you know, most days I hope we want to get out of bed.
Right.
But, for example, can you just give us a couple of thoughts about how good are the helmets we wear when we ride our bikes, and how good are the helmets we send our kids out with to play sports?
Well, most helmets are pretty effective and very good. The problem is that they don't get implemented nearly enough, and, you know, oftentimes the proper use of the helmet isn't employed. So, you know, if you're not using the helmet exactly as it's supposed to be used, then, you know, you're taking great risks there as well. So, I mean, there are many things that you can do that, you know, help lower the risk, but, you know, education is by far a big part of it. You know, the Brain Injury Association is happy to give out prevention brochures, and a lot of this is are things that just force you to be a little bit more, or encourage you, I should say, to be a little more careful about what it is that you do. So, for example, if you're elderly, you know, call someone to come change the light bulbs for you. You know, falls are a huge, huge cause for brain injury among the elderly. So those kind of practical things, you know.
There we have to leave it. Michael, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon and with our listeners.
Thank you, Celeste. I appreciate your interest in this.
Michael Paul Mason is the author of Head Cases, Stories of Brain Injury and Its Aftermath. The book is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. A portion of the proceeds from sales of the book will be donated to the Brain Injury Association of America.